You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. So welcome to episode 286, and in this one I interviewed Marion Moore. Marion shares her OCD story, which is her as the parent, and it was her daughter who experienced OCD. She shares her experience in the world of OCD and everything that goes with it as a parent. We talk about moral worries or moral scrupulosity, getting therapy for a daughter, what she learned as a parent of a child experiencing OCD, sharing common feelings together, getting started in advocacy, her advocacy initiatives she's involved with in New Zealand, how she uses her unique experience to advocate, words of hope, and much, much more. And thanks always to NoCD for supporting the show. I deeply appreciate it. If you want to find out more about NoCD and their therapy services, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories or click the link in the episode description. And as always, thank you so much for listening to the show. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Marion. Welcome to the show, Marion.
Kia ora, Stuart.
Hey, it's good to have you on. And yeah, as you know, it'd be great to hear your story. So what got you into being involved with the world of OCD, if I can say it like that?
I thought I might almost start a bit with what went well and then backtrack to what didn't go so well. And in a way, I've become involved in advocacy because of what went badly. And if the first part of my story was my whole story, then I think I would have just got on with my life and kind of sailed on. So when our daughter was in her first year at university, she rang me and she said, you know, I need to get some help. And she was reaching the point where her everyday kind of daily life, her ability to study and, you know, to actually just live away from home was becoming really challenging. And I had kind of been hoping for that phone call. And so as soon as she had sort of put her hand up, then with her permission, I rang the university, you know, medical center, and said, you know, my daughter's coming in tomorrow and she has moral OCD. And I said, the person on the end of the phone said, I've never heard of moral OCD. And that was exactly why I rang them. I said, yes, I fully expected you to say that. Please put her through, you know, to the mental health service and please tell them that she has moral OCD. And that part actually worked really smoothly. She quite quickly was put through to a psychologist in the student health who said, yes, he felt that that looked quite reasonable, is probably what the problem was. And so they had an in-house psychiatrist as part of the university. So, you know, quickly on medication, decision to take medication, and the person actually recommended everyday mindfulness for OCD.
Oh, yeah.
Charlene Isley and John Hirschfield's book. So we got to, and you know, we read that while we waited to organise a therapist. And we had a choice at that point as to whether to go in our public health system in New Zealand or whether to, you know, to go private. And we were at the point where we were in the middle of the university year and our daughter really wanted to continue studying. That was, you know, that was following her life. And also a lot of her triggers were in that environment. So she sort of really needed to stay there. And we were told that it was likely to take quite some months to get access in the public system. So we just said, right, we'll go private. And within you know, a month, 6 weeks maybe, we were with a private therapist who was experienced in OCD. And everything, you know, it was hard, but everything went really well. You know, our daughter worked really hard at it, and you know, we, you know, were there supporting her. And in about, within like about 4 months, she had finished therapy and she had the tools she needed and she was picking up her life. And she still had, you know, some more work to do to really get used to using those tools. But basically, it went really smoothly. And you could say that it was just such a good example of how, you know, getting the right support just changes your life. But the problem was that I had been waiting for that phone call from our daughter for years. And I had had to wait, you know, until she was ready to try. And it was a case of ready to try again, because the first time that we tried to get help, it didn't go at all well. So right back in really sort of midway through primary school, I was already beginning to notice some things that didn't feel quite right to me. But it was hard to put your finger on it. I guess a lot of parents probably. And it was around kind of ethical, moral things. So the school had they had a character program. So every term, the children would focus on a different value. And I think there were about 8 different values. So you would focus on kindness or responsibility or honesty. And the children would be, you know, they would be praised when they showed that value in their behaviour, which, I mean, it's totally a good thing. But it was, I noticed that there was kind of seemed to be a rigidity to it. It wasn't just that my daughter was choosing to do it in a positive, active way, but she actually kind of needed to be 100% honest. She kind of needed to be 100% kind. And there'd just be like little incidents. And I couldn't put my finger on it, you know, but I knew something wasn't, and I sort of talked to the teachers about it, and we talked about a little bit, you know, about how some people, you know, are kind of just naturally have high standards and things, you know, and I just never felt, I was never satisfied. And I talked to the GP and I was never, it was all, well, she's growing and she's finding herself. And I just never could quite, you know, it probably sounds familiar to people, this kind of just, as a parent, you sort of feel, you know, and yet you don't, you're not sure. I mean, I took our daughter to the GP a number of times as she was growing up to see whether she had appendicitis or not, you know, probably 3 or 4 times. And on the one hand, you sort of think, you've got to trust the GP, don't you? You know, at some point you have to. And so when it was like, well, okay, you know, a lot of kids are kind of, you know, that's just sort of, so you just, okay. But when she got to high school, by the time she was about 14, it was just increasingly I felt like this tension and kind of this lack of, I don't know, kind of a loss of kind of joy, if you know what I mean. And so I talked to the school again, and again, no, it was sort of can't quite. And I talked to a psychologist, and the psychologist said, well, I would need to see her, you know, understandably. And my daughter sort of was like, well, no, I'm fine. So finally, when she hit their first year of exams, of formal exams, everything just really kind of ramped up. And at that stage, I'd been doing like a lot of internet searching. And I'd been searching for things like anxiety mainly. So I was reading about social anxiety and generalized anxiety, and none of it really, because I felt it was sort of quite specific to certain sort of situations, and it just didn't feel right. And I was skimming right over OCD. It would sort of say, you know, in the listing, the various sorts of kind of anxiety type things that had mentioned OCD. And it would always mention like the hand washing thing as the example. It would say, you know, have these thoughts and so you wash your hands. And it didn't explain about intrusive thoughts or anything like that. So I would always just skim right past that. But eventually, by the time she was, yeah, 15, I was like, just by now I was looking, you know, down every little hint I could find. So I finally actually went further and looked up OCD further on different websites. And it was like, well, okay, it's not just hand washing. Maybe. And then I Googled morals and OCD because it always seemed to be morals. And I came up with this research article, like a really technical research article. But there seemed to be this thing about religion and scrupulosity and OCD and morals. And I thought, well, this isn't a religious issue we're having here, but it is a very moral issue. So when my daughter went to see a psychologist when she was 15, I had a little session beforehand, a chat with the psychologist. And I said, look, I really don't know, but I know something's going on. And could it be? Could it be moral OCD? You know, I didn't hardly know anything about OCD yet. And the psychologist sort of said, well, I've got to, you know, talk to your daughter, obviously. And because she's old enough, this will be private and she'll tell you what she wants to, but I won't tell you, you know, it's just what your daughter chooses to tell you. And she was very private about those sessions. And she did seem to be getting a bit better. She's learning some techniques about how to handle anxiety and about not seeking reassurance and things like that. And for a little while, things got better. And so she stopped seeing the psychologist. But fairly rapidly, it just came back. But it came back different. Now, instead of talking to me, because she'd been told she should try and handle these things herself, it all just went internal. And she'd say, I'd say, you seem a bit worried. And she'd say, well, yes, I am a bit worried, but I'm not supposed to talk about it. And so she wouldn't. And I'd say, well, I think maybe we need to get some more help. And she'd be like, no, it's my responsibility because I've been given these tools to use and now I just need to use them. So for 3 years it went on like this, where I was looking at her and thinking, there's so much bottled inside and I can't get at it, you know. So when I finally got that phone call 3 years later to say, you know, I really, it's time to do this again, it was such a contrast what happened. And it happened purely because I knew what I was asking for and I knew what I was looking for. So that really now is why I'm just so passionate about, you know, kind of spreading the word, because it would have made such a difference to us if we'd just got all that information earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, really, thank you for sharing. Really good points. And yeah, so she saw someone, when a psychologist, when she was 15, and then again at, was it 20, did you say?
She would have been 18.
Okay, so a few years on.
18, so yeah.
Yeah, well, and you said before that, like, you knew you just had to wait for that phone call from her to say, I'm ready, I need help. What was that like, waiting then for those 3 years? Because it can't have been easy.
It was, I mean, you tried to pull all this other stuff around, you know, like let's all go for a walk, let's all enjoy a movie. And and you were trying to continually prop things up, and you know, like, you were never getting at the root of it, but you were just trying to
support
without ever having the right tools, because you didn't actually know what you were dealing with. And then gradually, as I think it was sort of a time period where there was more, you know, there's been an explosion of stuff really on the internet, I think. Yeah. And in, I think it would have been late 2018, I read a blog by John Hirschfeld about moral OCD. And that for me was my absolute light bulb. I am totally certain now what we are dealing with moment.
Yeah.
But it was a question of then just sort of trying to gently kind of feed some of that information so that we could all start thinking about it as a family.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was, I think there's a thing when you have a baby, I think, where you never totally relax. Yeah. You always got an ear out. Yeah. And I think I just always, my antennae, my radar was, it was continually sounding at one level or another the entire time.
Mm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, which is stressful itself, right? And yeah, so when she got help the sort of last time, did you get involved in any way in the sense of, maybe with the psychologist or therapist, to kind of understand how you can help, you and the family can help, or were you kind of in the dark again?
I actually asked if I could go to a session, and it was never, I think it was just like, this, you know, when you're 18, you're kind of, you do maybe want to do some stuff, but no, what I did really was I found the OCD stories. what I really found was I looked for a support group, and I found Fix8, which is the group I'm a part of now. And at that stage there were only about 40 people in the group. It had been started by another parent and had been running about 2 years at that stage, and it was really quite small, but there were people suggesting a few books and a few podcasts and things. So I basically, of what was available at that time 2 years ago, I think I listened to just about every single OCD Stories podcast. And I you know, I looked at the ISDF sites, and I went to a local library and got the odd book out. I actually really found that Everyday Mindfulness was a really good one. My daughter and I, you know, we read that kind of jointly. She read it and I read it, and we talked about it a little bit. And I thought it might be a bit of a personality thing or whatever, but for us, that was exactly right. It had enough information, but kind of not too much. And it had some reasonably practical things to say about what you might kind of do next. And then it was me kind of sharing a bit with the wider family. Yeah.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I like the idea of reading the book together and then discussing it. Yeah, no, that's great. And you mentioned kind of a light bulb moment for you there. I was reading that article that John wrote about moral scrupulosity. What would you say was the biggest sort of roadblock for you and your daughter, and how did you overcome it?
Roadblock in terms of?
Just, it could be like getting treatment, or even getting to treatment, or in treatment, or you as a family member that just made life much more difficult
I think for me, it was just, you know, not knowing what it was. And so you weren't, I don't know, it was just such a, you were grappling with, you didn't know what the right thing was. Yeah, to me, it was hard, you know, ERP and, you know, it's really hard to see your child in distress.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really, really hard thing. But once I knew what it was, and I knew that what, and I could see, you know, that what we were doing was, you know, nibbling away, and it was making progress. Then that was, I don't know, it was kind of good pain. You know, like they talk, they talk about when you have a baby, you know, and about because you're having the baby, that the process is fine because you get a baby at the end of it, you know.
Yeah.
And to me, ERP really was the same. I had that. That faith, I suppose, that trust, but it was going to get the result that we were looking for. And so it was really the period before that, to me, that was the hard bit.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, so, you know, through your experience, for any sort of family members listening, obviously everything you've shared, I'm sure they would have learned a lot from already, but was there anything you'd summarize of that you wish you would have known, you know, 5 years ago as a family member?
I suppose some of the things, you know, the really basic things you learn about uncomfortable emotions are things that you can make room for, that you don't have to, you don't have to kind of make them go away. You don't have to say, I'm feeling uncomfortable, so I'm going to distract myself. Yeah. Or also that I'm feeling uncertain, you know, that I don't know what's going to happen. I think as a parent, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty. You don't know if you're doing the right thing or not. you learn as much as you can, and then you just have to put it into practice and hope, which is what parenting is like anyway, I guess. And yeah, so I think to know that you really kind of need to do one thing. You decide you're going to do something and you do one thing. And then and you just accept that you're doing your best, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, what I liked there was, you know, what came to me was, you know, your daughter was dealing with OCD and as a result of that, like uncertainty around what she was worrying about, and that was unsettling for her. You're now dealing with uncertainty around, am I doing the right thing? Is she going to get better? All of this. And in a way, that's a nice way to understand partly what she's experiencing, you know, it's a nice way to relate, I guess.
And we did talk about it like that a bit. Like I was fairly open saying, you know, that I also have uncertainty and I also, this is hard for me. So I suppose. In some ways there is a kind of, I didn't really think about it, but there's a kind of modelling in that when you're saying, actually, I'm sitting with some uncomfortable emotions right now too. and I'm uncertain now too, and just we're gonna be okay.
Yeah. It's powerful. Yeah, so they she and anyone else don't feel alone in that, you know. And it also, as you say, it models that uncertainty is a human thing. We all experience it at times to varying degrees, and you obviously show that, right, I'm uncertain, I don't like this, but I'm working through it, you know, I'm sitting with it, I'm whatever.
Yeah,
nice. Okay, let's talk about advocacy. So let's start off just by, where are you at with that, and how's it been going, and what are you doing?
Well, I guess really there's the sort of two aspects of it. There's the Fixate group that I joined, and quite early on, another parent and I, we kind of, she was kind of the parent that I vented to when I needed some support, you know, early on. And then we were both sort of in a position where our families were now in a better position. And we sort of said, you know, there's just such a need here. Mm. And we're actively trying to grow the group a bit by making it known. So making sure that if people were looking on the internet or talking to a therapist, that hopefully the group, the existence of the group would be mentioned. Mm. So we've got a bit over 500 members now, which is sort of steadily growing all the time. And with, because it's a Facebook group, they're actually right throughout the country. So New Zealand, there's about 5 million people scattered through the same land area as the UK, yeah, or same land area as Colorado. So a Facebook group works really well for us. And it means actually that the admins, so there's now 4 admins currently in the group, we keep an eye on things, but really it's the people who are in the group who are kind of supporting each other, mm-hmm, which makes it manageable. Like if one admin was trying to talk to 500 people, then it would just be the responsibility would immediately do you in, you know. But because you've got these 500 people supporting each other, and yes, the admin's keeping an eye on it, it all kind of works. And we have people in the group who are living with OCD, you know, who are in recovery or newly diagnosed or somewhere in between. And we have parents, we have partners, you know, there's a whole mixture of people in there. And so when someone asks for advice, you often get it from a number of points of view. It's just kind of really nice. So we're really happy with how that's running. And if the advocacy side of things sometimes is a wee bit like you try something and it doesn't work or something, you've always kind of got the comfort of knowing that the peer support side of things is, you know, ticking over nicely, and you feel like that's really worthwhile. So on the more kind of public awareness and access to treatment and all those sorts of things, we're really only just sort of trying a few things, I suppose. Mm. We set up a website fairly early on, which partly helps people find us, but it also, and that was set up by one of the other admins, Louise Aitken, and she handles all that side of things. So we each have our own little, even though we're not at all formal exactly, we each kind of have our own little passion. And one of my little passions is actually writing to, small passion is writing to the like the health websites and saying, please don't just use the example of hand washing, because when I was looking, that was very unhelpful. And we've done some newspaper articles where sometimes a journalist will approach us through our website, or sometimes we'll think that's kind of an audience we'd like. So recently we had an article on perinatal OCD in a Kiwi Parent magazine, which is targeted at sort of new parents. So the idea is that, you know, people reading that will get a little bit of a information. So we kind of, what we do is we, within the Facebook group, we'll put a wee post out saying, you know, this journalist is looking for a story on such and such in an angle, like perinatal or difficulty in accessing the health system or something like that. And would anyone be willing to share their story? And in that way, gradually, as people, I think, have kind of the example of other people doing it first, and it becomes a little bit more imaginable doing it, we've just gradually had more and more people become willing to either anonymously or actually, you know, publicly share their stories. We just had a really, I think really impactful article a week or so ago, because it was on our, really on the front pages of several of our main newspapers, and just changing that perception of what OCD is. I think we may, you know, be relatively behind perhaps with the UK or the US is, and just that understanding of what OCD is. So we're beginning to do those things, and we can look, of course, and we can see what's being done in the US or the UK or wherever, and that it really provides kind of a path for us.
No, that's really good. And the website is ocd.org.nz.
That's right. And so it's something that I guess, you know, we're just sort of growing a little bit over time. We're not really, we're making a few resources that we think we specifically need. So one thing we've made is we helped to write in collaboration with another organisation called PADA, which is about perinatal health. So together with them, we've specifically produced a little brochure on perinatal OCD, and we've been starting to go through the PADA. They have workshops all around the country where they have people like midwives come. And so we're looking at trying to give information about perinatal OCD out there to, you know, new mums and dads and midwives. And through that, get information into a lot of communities, because one of the things in terms of diversity, you know, how do you get it into diverse sort of ethnic communities or diverse language communities or whatever? And pretty much everybody has babies. So I kind of see it as actually been quite a good way to try and spread awareness right through a whole lot of communities. If you can simply have it the case that in that maternal health community and the maternal health professionals, that you're getting those messages out there.
Yeah, that's really smart. And I really liked how you haven't gone in and been like, let's just try and get national coverage. You've gone to the small pockets and you've really targeted those areas, which I think is a great way of reaching the masses, you know. And you, what was it like, you know, you, the thing I want to highlight is the thing that affected you and your daughter was the examples were just around contamination on all these websites. So you then specifically approached a lot of these websites and said, hey, in my experience, this wasn't helpful. Please change this, which I think we all have those things that set us back. And if we all tried to target those areas, we'd be filling a lot of the gaps. So I think that's great. A question. So with Fixate, when you joined with 40 people, was that still useful, that group? But now, you know, because now it's 500, which is wonderful. But when it was smaller, was it useful?
It's a different group now, I think. I think when it was first started, it was probably harder to find someone who was a more exact match, if you know what I mean. So if I went on there and said, okay, anybody share with me about moral OCD, I perhaps wasn't going to find anyone. Or if I went on there and I said, okay, I live in Dunedin, is anybody in Dunedin that I can have coffee with? And the answer was no, there's nobody in Dunedin. So it's good because there's a lot of networking that you can do now with more people, but it's also if you've got 500 people listening in on a conversation, it's a different vibe. But what I think more now is that we're getting sort of little splinter kind of, so is still part of, but for example, a parent with, you know, school, primary school age children has started having with other parents with kids, and they're having the odd Zoom meeting where the kids come on and just talk to each other. Okay. And so that's a new little thing that gives that kind of intimacy of that smaller thing, yeah. but still, you know, very much still part of the bigger group. Or you might have, just trying to think some of the other things. You might have just people say, you know, who lives here and who wants to have a coffee? Mm-hmm. And so in small ways, people are using it to find each other. And very early on, someone came into the group and they said, you know, I'm so pleased to have found this group because I've lived with OCD pretty much all my life. You know, I've lived with OCD for, shall I say 15 years, he's had OCD. And he says, I've never before talked to anybody who had OCD. And of course, it's not that he hadn't met them, because if 1 in 100 people have OCD, he's yeah. definitely met people who have OCD. But if nobody's talking about it, you don't find each other. So, it is a way of simply connecting.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love all those examples you gave. And I think, yeah, I had an agenda by asking that question, which was, I guess, because we were talking about advocacy before we started and how I was sharing how, you know, there's only going to be more projects and advocacy initiatives in other countries if they're started in those countries, you know, and you're a good example of that. And I guess my point is sometimes I think one myth that maybe or idea that people may think is it has to be massive to have any impact. And actually, when it was just 40 people, you still got some use out of it. It was still a useful group for you and your daughter. So, you know, people start these initiatives. It doesn't have to be big to be helpful or impactful, you know, and it will grow over time.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And it may change over time too, as people, you know, it sort of grows to be what you need it to be. But you do have that conversation with yourself, maybe with someone else about like, why hasn't anyone done this before? And if they haven't done it before, maybe thinking about doing it is a bad idea. So you have those kind of things, but really, you know, what actually are you risking? The Facebook, certainly the way we do it, you know, it's free. So we don't have any financials. We don't have any paperwork of setting up a formal organization. It might be that will come for us in time as there's enough people to do that and maybe a need to do it. But at the moment, it's just been such a really low barrier way of getting something going. I've belonged 20 years ago or more. I used to work in a gene mapping in a, you know, university researcher role, working with families with inherited blindness. And, you know, when I was involved with those consumer groups, you know, there were airfares and there were toll calls and there were all sorts of costs to actually trying to do anything, and people really needed to have actual in-person meetings. And so if you live somewhere reasonably remote, it was quite difficult. And I just think the whole having the Zoom meetings and having the Facebook-based nature, it's a really low barrier if you want to do something like this.
Absolutely. And then, you know, now you guys are you're doing the website and you're doing all these other ideas and initiatives that have come out from that initial Facebook group. So, yeah, what seems like a small beginning can quickly grow. Yeah.
I think I do a lot of, and I still have kind of cold calling in the sense of actually kind of email cold calling. And and a lot of it does get ignored. So those websites where I've asked them to change things, you know, I might have had three websites change things, and I might have had 12 websites not change anything. But actually, once I've written my little email, all I've got to do really is change the address at the top and push the send button. So there's very little cost to doing that.
I like that. And as you kind of alluded to just now, for some people, there is going to be that. Well, if no one's done this, is there a reason why they haven't done it? And I'm sure there's also like the imposter syndrome of who am I to be doing this? You know, when those things come up, if they do, how have you kind of dealt with them or worked with them?
I mean, because Fixate is a group, there's other people you can talk to. I've certainly, you know, I have lots of conversations with Louise. we talk to each other reasonably regularly, and it's just really nice because it's often just kind of a bit of a chewing of the fat thing, but it just sometimes it just settles in your own mind, kind of, even though it's a funny thing how just talking to someone else can be so helpful.
Yeah.
So I do think that it is really helpful to find somebody else. Yeah.
Mm.
It doesn't need to be 100 other people, but I do think that at least one is really good. And now, I mean, the lovely thing is that there's just more and more people popping up. You know, someone's willing to maybe be a speaker for things or, you know, maybe, yeah, it just seems to grow naturally.
Yeah, I love that. And also finding someone with a similar mission. So you and Louise are both kind of on the same path and you have the same similar goals in mind. And, you know, if you have a concern, there's a good chance she's had the same concern and vice versa.
Well, even kind of overlapping things a bit's quite good too, sort of the networking of that. So one of the admins in Fixate, actually, her main thing is actually her own very, very well organized thing called Voices of Hope, which is a mental health thing, probably more sort of younger people. So for OCD Awareness Week last year, we actually did a Facebook campaign where we had a different Facebook post each day of the week. We called it 7 days of OCD. And we don't have a public presence. We just have our private group. We don't have a public Facebook or Instagram or anything. And what happened was that she very kindly offered her platform and sent it out to her, I'm not sure, 20 or 30,000 followers. And what we did was we asked people to share it. So we called it Listen, Learn, Share. So the idea was that they read the post on Voices of Hope and then they share it on their personal page. And that then just amplifies the whole audience again. So the fact that she actually not so much was doing exactly what we're doing, but she had this whole other thing that we could plug into, has just been wonderful.
Yeah, I love that. Sorry. Yeah, really, really good idea. Okay, so the next question is more general. So just words of hope. So be it for family members or someone listening with OCD, what would you tell them?
I just think, you know, that there is hope. That I suppose I come back to what I said earlier, the do one thing. It doesn't matter if it's a do one thing in the sense of something just separate and enjoyable, like going for a walk or having an ice cream. It doesn't matter if it's do one thing in the sense of, you know, doing a little ERP task or something. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter what it is, but just and that's manageable. And then eventually you just find that you can look back and you can see that it kind of built. So I just think that you don't have to see the whole picture. You can, I'm not sure.
No, I like
To me, that's, to me, not having to try and think that I've got to handle everything at once. So I just, and some of those things do one thing. Definitely, they've got to be enjoyable things. You know, watch the movie.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's Desmond Tutu said, you eat an elephant a piece at a time. I think it was him. Otherwise it's overwhelming, you know. And I don't advocate eating elephants, by the way. That's just a saying.
And it's always also, it's also actually, to truly enjoy something, you've got to kind of be in the moment of enjoying it, don't you?
Yeah.
So it's,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so you can pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old version of yourself. What do you tell her?
Twenty-year-old version of myself. I was at university, and I was the first one in kind of my immediate family to go to university. And actually, deciding to go to university, that was fairly obvious, but I didn't really know what happened once you'd finished your degree. So when I was about 20, I was kind of like, well, I'm going to finish this degree soon, and then what happens? And I think really, again, I do think it's you just have to sort of try some stuff and just, have that faith that it all works out in the end, really.
Absolutely. Yeah, I like
it's
that.
It's the same message, isn't it? I should just put do one thing everywhere and it answers every question.
Well, it may answer the next one, which is if you've got a billboard, what do you want written on that billboard?
Oh, actually, no, look, I knew you were going to ask that and I thought about that. And I want to write something different.
Go for it.
Second. I've got a piece of paper because what I want to do is actually have a Māori proverb, a whakatauke.
Yeah.
And the whakatauke is e koe koe te tui, e keta keta te kākā, e kuku te kileru. Now the tui and the kākā and the kileru are all New Zealand birds. Two of them I have in my garden here, and the classrooms, I actually volunteer in a school, and the names of the classes I volunteer in are also called Tui and Kiriru, so they're very much part of my life. It translates as kind of the songs of the forest. So the Tui chatters, the Kākā gabbles, and the Kiriru coos. The idea is that everybody's different, and everybody's got their own kind of unique features and talents and contributions. And I kind of feel that that's what an OCD community should be. So whether it's your support group or your advocacy, that everybody's doing slightly different things. Maybe someone is willing to stand up in public. Maybe someone's really good at being a listening ear. Maybe, all sorts of things. And then maybe more internationally, that if you look at what we're doing here in New Zealand with a country of, 5 million and with people quite spread out in a certain sort of, cultural mix and so on, maybe what suits us is also going to be a little bit unique to us. And I would quite like to think, if you have at the bigger scale of the international OCD community, that maybe again that everybody being a little bit different in terms of what you know, the really well-organized countries versus the emerging countries versus that we're all kind of different birds in the forest, maybe.
Yeah.
There you go.
I really like that. Absolutely. The world needs individuals and it needs individual abilities and talents. And yeah, I like that. So lastly, is there anything else that you wish you could have said or shared today?
There is one thing that I'd be interested in really to find out whether other people are interested. When we're, especially in the very early stages, but also now, you know, developing our advocacy and our peer support, I'd be really interested to know what other people are doing in terms of those organisational things or fundraising or working out how to connect with clinicians. Or so I have wondered whether there'd be interest in some kind of communication group for people to just share in a really informal way. Maybe a Facebook group, would people be interested in having some kind of group like that? If people are interested, they could maybe email our website.
Yeah.
And we could think about that.
Absolutely. So that's a group of clinicians, advocates, anyone doing stuff in this space to share ideas so you can all grow together and work together.
Yeah. Just in a very informal kind of chatting kind of way.
Absolutely. So the link to Fixate for anyone in New Zealand and the link to the website for that offer and just anyone else that's interested will be in the show notes so they can check it out there. Well, thank you so much, Marion, for sharing your family story, your story and your advocacy. It's really inspiring to see, you know, how you're specifically trying to help and target New Zealand.
Thank you. It's been an honour.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, visit go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.